Now, you were telling me that you were in Glasgow right at the beginning of the war,
Yes.
when you joined up. And you joined up in October 1914. How old were you at that time?
16 on the February of that particular year. I was 16 on the 8th of February of that year.
Yeah.
So I was 16 and so many months, shall I say.
How did you manage to actually get into the RNVR as a 16-year-old? Because you're obviously well underage.
Well, I think I told you, and you'll see on my papers, that I'm down there as having been born in 1896, which I wasn't. I put my age on.
So where did you actually present yourself?
I think it was at the City Hall, the City Hall, which was the recruiting centre on that particular day.
And how did people react to you as a young 16-year-old trying to get into the RNVR?
There did not appear to be any trouble of any kind.
No questions?
No questions at all. I simply walked in with all the other people who were prepared to join up, and I was accepted, and the Marquess of Graham, who was the recruiting officer then, said, "And what is your age, young man?" I said, 19, sir, and he shook me by the hand. Then I was pushed into another room where I saw a medical officer who examined me.
After you joined up at Glasgow, you went to the Crystal Palace. What sort of impression did the Crystal Palace make to you as a place when you first arrived there?
Magnificent.
Go on.
It was very big. It was very nice. I like big places. I like lots of fresh air. There's lots of freedom to stretch oneself. And all in all, I liked the situation.
Now, how was the palace actually split up and used by the Royal Naval? Was it the Royal Naval Division or the Royal Naval Brigade?
It was Royal Naval Division from the very beginning in print, although we were not a division to begin with. We were ultimately a division, but to begin with we were a brigade. And the brigade consisted of, at that time, Royal Naval Reserve, Royal Fleet Reserve, Royal Marines, Royal Marine Light Infantry, and all the other factions of the Marines, including our own medical corps, our own transport corps, and so on.
Hold it.
It was split up. The palace was split up into big containments, houses, buildings. They were big buildings. It was a very big thing, the palace. And as I told you, the various buildings had names of the Commonwealth, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and so on, for some peculiar reason. And so many were housed in Canada, so many in each, and the several buildings that were around. The grounds of the palace were very extensive and gave us lots of room for our various drills, squad drill, company drill, and for our PT affairs, physical training affairs, and for entertainments. And I think by and large it was a huge complex of a place, not dissimilar from what it is today.
Doesn't exist today.
Well, what there is there. You see, the Crystal Palace is in use today for a variety of things, training, teaching, and all manner of things. They run courses there today in swimming and various other recreative facilities.
Now, during the period you were at Crystal Palace, one of the interesting events which took place was that the Royal Naval component was selected for the Antwerp expedition.
No. It wasn't selected for them.
When the Antwerp expedition was organised, can you remember any of the details about the way the people were selected for the Antwerp expedition and what preparations were made by the people that were selected?
The preparation was minimal. The men chosen appeared to me at the time to be the biggest, the most stalwart of the people who were there. And they were invested with, on top of their naval uniform, a khaki coat and little khaki gaiters. They were given rifles and ammunition and a haversack of sorts to carry on their back, and that was about all. And off they went. But there was no special training. In fact, they were not trained for such an expedition.
Mm-hmm.
There were men willing to do anything that the country required of them, and that was about all.
Mm. Now, I'd like to get you to tell me about how the naval division at Crystal Palace was organized. Now, you've told me that there were sections which had the name Victory as a nomenclature to describe them, that there were various units that were given the title of ships, like the Benbow Division. How, when you got to Crystal Palace, how were you split up as individuals into various component parts of the naval force that was based there?
Well, it was general. There were no such thing. There was no such thing to begin with as the Benbow or the Hood or the Hawk. We were simply a bunch of men who had enrolled for the purpose of the war, you see, and we were under the banner of the Royal Naval Volunteer Reserve, plus all these older ones who were Naval Reserve and Fleet Reserve and so on, who also came there. And we were, a lot of us, some of them at any rate, were Marines who were there for the purpose of training, purely for the purpose of training and teaching us. And as a whole, and in general, we were given exercises. We had PT first thing in the morning. We had squad drill and that sort of thing, and general disciplinary training to begin with. And there was no separation in any shape or form. We were merely housed in these various buildings, and when the roll call at 6 o'clock was called, there we were, and we were sent about our various divisions in the form of exercise, etc.
Did your training differ in any ways from that of a, say, purely army infantry unit?
I wouldn't say it did, not to begin with. It was a question of PT, squad drill, exercise in general, and lectures, discipline.
Now, you were part of a section that was called Victory 3 when you first
I
went
think you
there.
got, yes, that's true.
What was this? What did this mean, actually, this label?
This label, the victory, the first victory nomination applied to the Crystal Palace, which was HMS Victory. It was a ship, and that was the place where the recruits went, where everybody went in the very beginning, you see. And then, as our training advanced and we moved on to Blandford, then we were members of another ship, also called Victory, whatever the number may have been, which I think you have already.
Oh, I see. So you, as you started off at Victory 6, I take it from that you were the sixth unit that had been recruited at the Victory.
I suppose.
Yeah. And as you got more proficient, they changed the numbering system, didn't they?
Yes, they changed the numbering system. You were still Victory, whatever it was, HMS Victory, whatever number it was, until you reached the state of proficiency when you were then part of a battalion. You see, and that battalion might be the 1st, 2nd, 3rd, or 4th Reserve Battalion in preparation for going wherever we were required. And then, about that time, you were then put into the various factions known as Benbow Battalion, Hood Battalion, Drake Battalion, Anson Battalion, Collingwood Battalion. All these various battalions, you see, and then they had their own particular officers in charge of them, and they led a somewhat separate existence from each other until they began to get what we call full divisional, full brigade training, and then ultimately full divisional training.
Now, one of the things about that interests me about the Naval Division is that it was a naval force, yet it had a military function.
Ultimately.
Ultimately, yeah. And one of the points you've already stressed is that despite the fact that you had this military rather than a naval function, you retained all of the paraphernalia of
The
the
Navy.
Navy. And I noticed in the notes of yours, which I read, you said that our nomenclature, ceremonial traditions, etc., etc., were naval.
Yes, to the very end.
I wonder if you could detail this for me. I mean, for example, what kind of ceremonial and traditions did the Royal Naval Division have?
Well, if you were going on leave, you were going ashore. If you were late in returning, you see, you were adrift. These are the sort of things. We had the various badges emblazoned on our gun carriages, on our uniforms, on our baggage, which were purely naval badges. We had the naval pennants where we had our camp. Our badges, I think, as I related before, were entirely Navy. The main cap badge for the men, of course, was Royal Naval Division, or when you became Hood Battalion, it was Hood Battalion around your cady, around your cap. And the NCOs would have, for leading seaman, a red anchor on his khaki uniform. It'd have the equivalent of two stripes, as you might have had in the army, a corporal's rating. The petty officer had crossed anchors and so on, and the warrant officer all had naval badges. Mm-hmm. But to begin with, they were all entirely naval uniform, and they did the sort of drill and physical training that you'd find at Dartmouth College to begin the day with, you see, until you went to classes on whatever the subject may be, which might be a little bit of navigation, a little bit of map reading, general lectures on discipline.
Were your rates of pay military or naval?
Naval. Everything was naval, absolutely naval, to the very end. The pay, if I remember rightly, a soldier was getting something like a bob a day, shilling a day, and his equivalent naval rating was getting 11 shillings a week.
Mm-hmm. I see. Good. Now, after a period of equipping at Crystal Palace, you were organized into the Benbow Battalion.
That's right.
And you went with that battalion to
Blandford.
In February 1915.
Yes.
Was at that time, was Blandford a headquarters for the Benbow Battalion only?
No. The Blandford camp was a very large camp, you see, that was being prepared for the reception of units. But we could only send so many there at a time, so therefore although we were ready to go, we were delayed until the beginning of the next year before we could go to Blandford, because there weren't hutments or anything else for us, you see. So the camp was prepared, and as soon as we were ready, the Portsmouth Marines went there first, and so on. And ultimately we went to Blandford, and the camp was more or less settled down and became the real place for the training of the Royal Naval Division.
So when you got there, in fact, apart from Benbow Battalion, of which you were a member, there were several other battalions there as well.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Do you remember what other battalions
were
there?
Yes. The Hood and the Hawk and the Drake and the Collingwood. And I think that was about all, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. So there were four battalions
at least,
in all
there. Yeah. At least four battalions. Mm. The Hood. The Howe, H-O-W-E, Howe, was another one. Mm. The Howe, that's five. A marine battalion.
Hmm. Yeah. What was the station like when you got there? Was it a new station or
a new station? Hmm. A new station entirely. The downs were being prepared for the reception of the Royal Naval Division. Hmm. Hutments erected, canteens erected. The YMCA got there. Church huts were put up, and so on and so forth, to make a real military or naval camp for the reception of people like ourselves.
So, in fact, by the time you arrived, there was a naval division there?
There was some. There were some of the Portsmouth Marines and the Hood Battalion were there. And then the Benbow and Collingwood joined them in February.
I see. Mm. Yes. Now, you've told me that the unit at Blandford was entirely self-contained, like a military division.
Completely.
It had all the various arms of a division.
Completely.
Such as, for example, transport, medical, and so
transport,
on.
Transport, medical, everything.
Yeah. Could you cast your memory back and describe, apart from the battalions themselves, what other elements went to make up the unit that was at Blandford when you got there?
Already we had transport. We had our medical side. We had Marines.
Could you break these down as you describe them? For example, you said already we had our transport. Okay, what did it consist of?
It consists of mostly, in those days, horses. I didn't see many mules in those days. We had mules later on, but we had horses, and we had the usual vehicles that most army transports would have, you see. We had some lorries, we had some vans, we had motor vehicles, we had lots of horse vehicles in those days. We had a particular transport officer, and we had men who were dedicated entirely to transportation of troops and equipment.
Mm. Then there was a medical unit.
And then there was an entirely medical unit, which was not REMC, but was RNVR or RND medical unit.
And what did that consist of?
That consists of ambulance men, men who were trained in a little more in advance of first aid, doctors. There were no nurses. If there was any hospitalization, they were sent out of the camp, you see. But there were first aid posts and things of that kind.
So, apart from medical, what else was there?
Let me think.
Sorry, was this a large Marine contingent?
RMLI, Royal Marine Light Infantry.
Yes.
Yes, the Portsmouth Division.
Mm.
Then. And many of the older officers and NCOs, of course, old Marines, some that had retired and come back into the services again, they were our instructors and excellent instructors they were too. Many of the officers were Marines as our instructors, mostly Marines.
Yeah.
I think I made all that clear in my notes, I think, in detail, in naming the men concerned.
Now, during the period you were there, you were preparing for the Gallipoli expedition. As you got ready to go to Gallipoli, did your training and equipment alter at all?
Yes.
In what way?
Well, we then began to have such things as, more modern rifles, more modern bayonets, more modern kit in general.
In what way was it more modern?
Well, we had, instead of the long Lee Enfield rifles, we had the short Lee Enfield. I believe, it wasn't my concern at the time, but I believe we had more up-to-date Lewis guns, things of that nature. Our training then began to open up a bit, and we were having, shall we say, extensive training in groundwork. In advancing and in retiring and so on, and in having mock battles, in doing brigade training instead of actual company training and battalion training, and that sort of thing in general. Lots of emphasis on fighting.
Right.